Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 141. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today, we have a diminutive crew of James Jones.
Hey.
And Greg Lay.
Ahoy, hoy.
That was just sad.
Yours was sad, James.
They're both sad.
Unfortunately, John cannot be with us this week. He's on travel, and it's just going to be the three of us this week. So, we're going to jump into new business here. Oh, I do want to say real quickly, if you want to hear more from John, you can look on the staff blog on Nintendo World Report and see the video of him unboxing his DSi.
Oh,
so
God.
If you've ever wondered what he looks like or you just want to hear more of his voice in his absence, go see that video.
The continuing trend of unboxing videos on the site. So
yeah.
The play on Wii.
They're pretty popular.
Yeah,
to vicariously live the experience.
I don't understand the appeal of watching someone unbox something.
Don't talk it down too much.
It's kind of the gaming site equivalent of Dancing with the Stars, but some people like that kind of thing. So anyway, in terms of new business, Greg is going to get us started.
Okay, so I'll start off. So I sort of mentioned in passing last week about playing Final Fantasy IV. I've been playing it a bit more. I haven't had too much of an opportunity to play a lot of it, but I'm about just under 5 hours in. For people who do know the game, I'm at the Mount Ordeals or whatever it's called, Johnny?
Ah, yes.
Yeah, so it's still pretty early in the game. I think that's fair
to say.
So
you've got Rydia learning how to use fire? Or is that at Mount Hobbs?
I think that's a little early.
Mount Ordeals is... Oh, yeah. Where, that's where you've got Palom and Porom.
Yeah, that's right. You've got the twins and... Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite parts of the game, really. Shit's about to go crazy, just so you know.
Shit's about to get real?
Yeah.
Oh, God. if anyone listened to last week's listen up, that phrase might resonate with them a little too much. I'll leave it at that. I've been really enjoying the game. The first thing I want to talk about with it is kind of ties into our discussion of Secret of Mana, actually, in the sense that I really like the sort of central kind of, well, not so much the central, but the sort of the essential part of the story about the lead character, Cecil, and stuff, because it's so different from the kind of hero's journey template that's used in so many fantasy video games obviously was sort of probably most famously used by Star Wars with Luke Skywalker, in terms of, you know, humble beginnings boy gets drawn into giant sort of world events and ends up saving stuff, you know, destiny, all that. Yeah, you know. And what I like about Cecil in this is he's already a sort of important man. And he's already sort of learned in combat and all these sorts of things. You know, he's not some boy or anything. And obviously, he has all these sort of moral ambiguity things going on in the beginning of the story too. So, it's very different for me. I mean, perhaps if you've played a lot more Final Fantasy games or a lot more RPGs, this is not such a novelty.
I think FF4 is fairly unique in that regard, at least compared to other Final Fantasy. I hate the term fairly unique. That's terrible.
I would say, as far as the early games are concerned, yes. Some of the later games, they do introduce the character as already having combat experience and moral ambiguity.
Sure.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me, but certainly in my experience, it's pretty unique. And so I like that. I just think it's kind of more interesting to have somebody that's already got, you know, connections and things in the world that kind of pre-exist, rather than just this person that just sort of doesn't know. You know, a lot of the time, you think of Chrono Trigger as well, or the Zeldas. You know,
Chrono's almost a non-character, you know.
He is, you know, because it's like all he has is like his mother, who is a trivial character. But everything else he experiences is kind of completely like new. You know, there's nothing pre-existing about him. He's a complete blank slate, and it's much the same with Link. Usually, you know, most of the games he doesn't have.
I would say with Link, it's even more so the case, because usually in some of the games, he even has less characters who already
sometimes, like, you get, you know, similar sort of stuff is that his uncle in Link to the Past, or his grandma in Wind Waker, or, you know, these sorts of things. It's always fairly trivial characters, and basically everything's new, everything's, you know, he's this sort of unimportant person that becomes important during the course of the story, whereas with Cecil, he's got this standing already, and then obviously he goes through a journey, you know, that's quite eventful as the game progresses. On the complete other side of the game, in terms of the battle the battle mechanics and everything. I really like those so far. First of all, I like the fact you can change up the speed. I think it's very nice, because there are times when you'll want to speed things along and like, let's get on with this, let's just kill stuff, because yeah, random, there are random battles in the game which are never going to sit that well with me, but you know, because you can kind of, they're not too frequent, and because you can kind of soldier through them pretty quickly by cranking up the speed and getting on with it, then they're not too bad. But then on the other hand, there'll be certain occasions where, you know, you'll want to have to take, because it's kind of this active time battle system that we've seen in Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy VI, I think, back in the mid-90s. I assume this would not have been in the original 4, but has been kind of retrofitted into it.
Ah, the active time battle stuff,
because I was always under the impression it was new for like 3 and Final Fantasy 3/6 and Chrono Trigger.
Final Fantasy 6 introduced the ATB, yes.
Right, so okay. So it is. So it has been sort of retrofitted into it, and
it didn't come out of nowhere. There were kind of things in there that were the bar, the progressing bar, but I think this is the true active time battle.
So you've got that, and the point, what that means is that, you know, if you just sort of sit there dithering, you can get hurt by the enemies and stuff. So sometimes it helps to sort of, if you slow the whole thing down a bit and you want to consider your strategic options a bit, it gives you a bit more time to do it and deal with it in certain battles where you might like that. So you've got this sort of customization, and then the other part of it that I like is the fact that especially with the major battles, it does feel strategic rather than simply rather than just like a sort of watermark of like, did you level your characters up high enough?
Of what Dragon Quest bosses are
that is the impression that I've gotten from reading about those games.
And if you didn't, you lose.
It really isn't so much with this. You know, and I'm sure there's greater sophistication to be found throughout the course of the game. But, you know, the battles that I've had so far are very much, you would die sort of a bit old school, really, trial and error. You know, you'd try a few things and, you know, you'd end up getting countered with something and killed immediately. It's like, okay, that didn't work. Let's come back and try something else. And so, yeah, that is something that appeals to me, you know, even though it's in a sort of different form than I've experienced it in other genres. So I like that so far as well. And I guess the last thing I want to talk about is sort of the graphics, the 3D graphics. I tend to be a proponent of using 2D art in these games because I just think it looks nicer generally. But I could kind of see the upside of the 3D with this, because it really helps them with the storytelling in terms of the cutscenes, where you put the camera, and you know, sort of your more sort of cinematic direction, different kinds of shots you can use. Obviously, if you go 2D. There's not really anything you can do, you know, unfortunately.
And it was hard to deliver any kind of drama through the text either back in those days.
Yeah.
Whereas they have more capability to do that now, not only with the text, but with the voice acting.
Yeah, you've got the voice acting's in there, and it's I like the sound quality is very good of the voice acting, actually, because I reviewed, and this is not a game I actually talked about at the time, apart from a glib reference, I reviewed that Spyro Dawn of the Dragon game for DS with the famous voice cast. We had like Gary Oldman, Elijah Wood, and Christina Ricci, and all these people. And there's barely any voice in the game. It's a very insubstantial game, and it sounds terrible. So I was kind of expecting it to sound bad in this, because it's like, well, they're probably packing way more into this card, you know, so in terms of compression and stuff, you know, it'll probably sound no better, but it does sound better. Yeah. So there you go.
I think FF4 is probably the only a Square DS game that earns the Square tax.
In terms of the production values?
Yeah, I mean, in terms, you know, the Square, they also always sell their games at a sort of a premium $40 over other third-party DS games. And I think FF4 is really the one game that actually, you know, makes it worthwhile. It feels like they spent $10 more per cartridge in making the game. Because it is that good. I mean, the production values are so high.
And also, well, about the 3D graphics, they are very nice in the end. The only thing I kind of noticed was when you're like running around in like the overworld or whatever, the animation's kind of silly. It's like they kind of sped it up in terms of they wanted it to move faster, but they didn't really account for that. So he just kind of glides. You know what I mean? It's like he's kind of ice skating along.
Looks
he's
weird.
This big guy in this black armor, and you know, he's just sort of going, ooh, you know, that's kind of, but it's pretty trivial, you know, it's not really very important at all. So that's going really well so far. It's probably going to be the kind of thing I'm going to chip away at fairly slowly over a long period, and it's really good for that. So I'm definitely looking forward to getting deeper and deeper into it. The other thing I thought I'd mention, is. With the Japanese Nintendo channel, you often get a little window into the future on DS demos. And one that I picked up recently was the Space Invaders Extreme 2 demo, which has... I think it came out at the end of March in Japan, and it has been listed... Well, not exactly, but Space Invaders Extreme Remix has been listed for a summer release in Europe, so I assume that's going to be, you know, how it will be released in the West, and... shouldn't be too long. we'll get to that. So yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. I mean, it's very, I guess the remix moniker for the West kind of gives that away. The only difference that I could really detect is they do some extra stuff with the dual screens because you haven't got a PSP version this time, so they're not really constrained in terms of, you know, keeping them kind of, you know, fundamentally the same to work for, you know, very different sort of screen configuration. So this time, for instance, when you're going into Fever Time, like, you know, where before, like, the game would kind of stop and you'd have to shoot the sort of wheel to see what you were going to get.
Oh, yeah.
Now that kind of goes on while the game on the bottom screen is still taking place. So it, just little things like that. I mean, the demo itself is only the first level, so you're not really seeing a great deal there.
Did you see any new weapons?
No, I didn't. There is something different, I think, about the black power-up in the game. Like, that was a shield before.
I
believe that has been changed, but I didn't see that in the first level. Again, it's the first level. You ain't going to see that much. And I believe that the multiplayer has also been in some way beefed up.
Maybe they've made it worth playing.
Yeah, not one of the more notable parts of that game, which I like a great deal. So I mean, if the price is right, I might consider getting this at some point. But, you know, it does sound kind of trivially different at the minute.
The one thing I would really want them to do in a sequel to that game, and I also really like the first one, Space Invaders Extreme, but... the one improvement I would suggest is allowing you to adjust the sensitivity of the controls with the D-pad, especially since in the West we didn't get the dial controller.
The only thing I could tell you about the controls is that it felt pretty much exactly the same, but obviously it wouldn't have, like, the demo wouldn't have options. So
right.
I don't know about that part of it. It does support the paddle controller again. So I'm sure John will be thrilled with paying off that investment that
That's
he made
right.
in the paddle controller. but yeah, I mean, I agree with that because, you know, it just seems, considering that paddle controller is so kind of so much kind of better by all accounts, like, it would be nice to be able to maybe fine tune the D-pad control a bit to your liking at least. But I think, like, they're a bit like, they want to keep, I think the problem with that is, like, they want to keep that as this quote unquote standard control because, like, that's what goes on the online leaderboards, so maybe they wouldn't be too comfortable with people, like, tweaking it or something. I don't know.
So if you play with a paddle controller, your scores don't go on the leaderboard?
No, you can't. Yeah, anything you rack up with the paddle controller is not something you can upload.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean that sounds fair to keep a standard, but just in terms of getting through the game progression, I would like the option to be able to move faster.
Yeah, they could apply the same thing. That's true. Yeah, they could apply the same. Just like, okay, if you're doing, like, you know, the leaderboards one, you have to play not just with the D-pad, but like the standard D-pad, and
sure.
then have it sort of configurable over the other one.
So really quick, tell us about Fatal Frame 4.
Okay, so yeah, this bizarre ongoing situation that I thought I'd bring up with Fatal Frame 4, but it's like, so. Apparently, Nintendo is not going to publish it in America.
No.
Reginald Fils-Aimé has said that we are not the publisher of that in the Americas, I think is the quote. But there were indications from the official Nintendo magazine in Britain back in the end of last year that it was going to come out in February of this year. Obviously, that didn't happen. There were these scans of a French print ad for it that appeared that sort of suggested it was going to be coming out in May. And then, like, somebody has got a comment. I think Spong got a comment.
Oh, so it's
from,
guaranteed to be wrong.
Oh, I know. Supposedly got a comment from Nintendo of Europe that said they were not bringing it out. I mean, it's just messy, to say the least. And I guess the last thing that the Tecmo was what really caused the uproar was that somebody from Tecmo, in response to inquiries that were made after what Reggie said came out, were saying that basically, well, you know, we're sad that people aren't going to get the chance to play this game because Nintendo of America have decided not to publish it, but we respect their decision. So they were kind of closing the door on anybody else picking it up or, you know, it ever coming out and all. So it's a real mess.
Well, it gets weirder, though, because who was it? Somebody from Xseed made a very strange comment about the game.
It was sort of vaguely implied, like, oh, I'm sure it will come out eventually. I don't know whether it was meant to be sort of innuendo for they will pursue it if or what. So, yeah, this is where we are. We pretty much have no idea what's going to happen with it.
Well, from Tecmo's comment, it sounds like a company like Xseed would not have the opportunity. I mean, it sounds like Nintendo is hoarding the distribution rights in North America, because Tecmo pretty clearly indicated that they wish they could publish it, but they don't have the rights to do so.
That's right. That is how it sounds
in Japan. So, I mean, they would be the second choice, you'd think. But it sounds like Nintendo's like, if we're not going to release it, nobody's going to release it.
Yeah, they have the rights. So it's very peculiar situation. I'm not sure what to believe precisely. And of course, it kind of raises the specter of disaster not getting published in America.
Oh, why'd you have to go there?
But what we know about disaster in America is that is not the product of Nintendo of Japan, because Nintendo of Japan cleared it for Europe. So presumably they wouldn't have issued some sort of restriction on America. The Nintendo of America would have decided not to publish it. Whereas if this doesn't come to both Western territories, it may be that in fact Nintendo of Japan is behind this. This time, I don't know. It's kind of sad. I mean, I'm not. There did sound like there were some issues with the game, but it certainly passes the quality threshold. And we were talking, Nintendo has published Donkey Kong Bongo Blast or whatever this generation. The bar is not that high. I mean, I wasn't blown away by Disaster Day of Crisis, to say the least. But
Here, when people like Reggie make decisions on, you know, are we going to sell this or not in America? It's not based on how good they think the game is.
It's based on how many
units they think they can sell.
No, but there was some people had kind of said, you know, oh, with Disaster, you know, it's like, oh, well, it's not that good or whatever. And it's like, well, that's not the reason it's not getting published. And
Reggie's not a game critic.
If it were complete shit and they thought they'd make money on it, it would be out.
And
right
there
now.
Again, you know, with Fatal Frame, even though supposedly these there's some control peculiarities that people have expressed concern
there
about.
There are, yes.
By all accounts, it is generally a pretty damn good game. So it's kind of disturbing that we wouldn't get the chance to play it. Yeah. Really, I think it'd be quite sad.
Well, if it does come out in May in Europe, Greg, do you think you would consider getting it?
I would definitely
consider the Japanese version.
I think the text issue would be a bit too much of a problem there.
It's like a Resident Evil game where a lot of the puzzles come from the item.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably at this point some relatively well-developed sort of FAQs for it.
Yeah, but
so it's somewhat pursuable. And I mean, if we were to come to a point where it was made perfectly clear that would be the only way you'd ever experience it, I might go that way because I have a Japanese Wii, but you'd rather not.
Yeah. Okay, James, what do you have for new business?
So, besides continuing my adventures through a fun park, which are neither fun, though moderately like a park, today I became whole by completing a working Virtual Boy in my home.
Wow.
I had a component or two, but I now have a completely functioning Virtual Boy.
Is this Virtual Boy like custom? Have you like
no?
Is
I, this I haven't
sort of hot
it out yet.
Rod Virtual Boy.
The three games that came into my possession are Mario Tennis or Mario's Tennis. Excuse me. It's not
yeah,
Mario
that's
tennis.
Correct. Yeah.
Teleroboxer, which is a difficult name to say, and Vertical Force, which I had not even heard of until it showed up in the box with Teleroboxer.
I'm not familiar with that one.
I've forgotten, you know, just it's still kind of amazing to look through it and that it's actually 3D. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's really cool looking.
The effect works, you mean?
Yeah, it works. Really. It works really well. I mean, it kind of sucks that it didn't catch on because all of these games, even Vertical Force, kind of have something going there. But they were so early in the game. Think about the first few DS games, the first generation of DS games.
Yeah, there was no maturation with Virtual Boy because it kind of sank before it had
before
the chance.
We had real good games in there. Well, there's the only one that I really, really want is Wario Land.
Wario, which is awesome.
Yes, because that's apparently the maturation taking place right there. That's what
now, James, I don't know what the state is of ROM hacking or ROM dumping, but I know there is a demo out there somewhere of G-Zero, which is the Virtual Boy sequel to F-Zero, where you can move up and down in addition to left and right. So instead of friction, instead of zero friction, there's zero gravity. That's where the name comes from.
I need to figure out how to deal with that. Get that going.
So yeah, I mean, you might want to look into that. I don't know if they're like Virtual Boy flash cartridges.
Well, the Virtual Boy has such a bizarre cartridge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's less than a quarter of an inch thick, but it's wide and it's deep, and it's probably got 50 pins on it. It's a very strange little cartridge. All the cover art's the same on all of them, though. It's quite early Sega-esque. It's bizarre. All the cover art.
Yeah, sort of standardized.
Yeah, it is. But so I'll go through them one by one. So Mario's Tennis. That's hard. It really is. It's just a tennis game. But I mean, the cool feature is that the ball comes at you and goes away from you.
Mm-hmm. So it was. I mean, obviously this is not a concern for you, but I mean, would this have had like multiplayer? Would that have been possible?
Yes, but it had multiplayer.
It does. Yeah, they had two-player multiplayer.
It had multiplayer in the same way that the Game Boy had multiplayer.
Yeah, but as you know, I assume that's the kind of problem with that game in some sense, is that, you know, like the most enjoyment to be had from it would have been playing multiplayer. But I mean, who had a friend with a Virtual Boy?
I'm not sure how multiplayer would have worked with the Virtual Boy, though, because you can't see your friend because your head's buried into the head unit. You probably can't hear your friend because you're probably
using
headphones.
They're always going to be more interesting than they are your opponent,
right?
Well. See, that brings me to Teleroboxer, because the AI opponents are destroying me. they're so hard, and it's just, you know, I haven't figured out how to block and stuff.
So is that like a lot like Punch-Out?
It is, in fact, made by the same team that made Punch-Out.
Wow.
So it might be good.
It's from what I've played, it seems okay. I mean, it's one of the most highly regarded games on the system. It's got some neat 3D effects in it, too. But, you know...
And what is what is Vertical Force?
Vertical Force. That's the game that I've actually spent the most time on. I just got the thing today, which surprised me. Vertical Force is a shoot-em-up to placate Greg.
Well, no, you could say the more abbreviated version correctly.
It does, but it exists in all three dimensions, so the face buttons actually cause you to go up and down.
So is this a bit like Star Fox?
No, because it's overhead, so it's more like...
No, it is overhead, so it's more like Soldier Blade or Star Soldier.
Yeah, I was going to go 1942, but yeah, that works.
Well, yeah, that's good.
But
this sounds really cool. I mean, or it sounds like it could be really cool.
But there's two planes of enemies, and you can clearly see the division in the planes there, which is nice. So you can go up and down between them, and there's obstacles on certain planes that you have to go up to get around and come back down.
Well, hot damn. That sounds really, really good to me.
Well, it also sounds like a way of actually changing up vertical scrolling gameplay.
Because
there are so many of those games, and they're not very different.
So I have one other game coming. What was the other shooter for that system? Red Alert.
Oh, is that the one that's like Star Fox?
That's the one that's like Star Fox. That's the very desirable one.
Is it a helicopter game?
No, it's like Star Fox, really. It's wireframe.
Wow.
You're behind the point of view like the SNES Star Fox, but it really is that 3D effect. I've heard it's very disorienting to play, though, after a while. I always downplayed, it wasn't that bad on your eyes, and it isn't while you're playing it. where it gets you is when you step back from the system and you walk away from it. Because then your eyes go, holy shit, what was that? and before every game, you're prompted with, I think, would you like it to automatic, would you like auto pause on off? That's all it says. It's very strange what that means.
What is auto pause?
So I actually went and looked it up. And what it does is, between, if you say yes, between levels, the game will pause. And it won't start until you press a button. So it gives you a chance to step back and let your eyes rest. And every Virtual Boy game has that.
They did product test this. They knew what it was doing to people.
Now,
they weren't oblivious to the eye strain. That's great. You're making me really want a virtual.
You know, they're not
James.
That bad.
I thought it was unworkable, Johnny. I thought, where would I put it? And, well, what would I do when people found out? I'd be blackballed from the academic community or whatever.
I could stow it under the
They only sold 770,000 of these things, and I got mine for $60, which isn't bad. I mean,
that's not
the
bad.
Whole unit, three games, the controller. Now, the worst thing about the Virtual Boy isn't the graphics, it's that damn controller.
So this was really weird. It was like a double prong controller, but the both sides were the same.
Yes, they were.
Both had D-pads, both had
V and
A. It
kind of looks like a GameCube controller,
but with both sides being the
now,
same. Yeah.
Well, what you're not seeing, though, because all the pictures of the Virtual Boy controller are from the top, is in profile, it is fucked up looking. Because the Virtual Boy ran off batteries. Now, there was an AC adapter, but it ran off batteries normally.
Oh, yeah.
And
I think
the
I've
battery
seen what
pack is six AAAs in the controller to give the controller some heft.
Yeah, and so what happens is, like, can it easily, like, come out of your controller and then, like, the power...
I guess it could, but the real issue is that the controller pack extends well beyond your hand, so there's this big, like, dead weight in the middle of the controller. It's, like, dipping down in the front. And then to get around it, the control handles come off kind of like ham hocks. It's bizarre. And they've got like grips cut into it that clearly aren't meant for adult hands. And they've got trigger buttons that are just two face buttons attached to the bottom of these controllers. It's so weird.
Yeah.
Now, what is kind of sad about the Virtual Boy is that, you know, yeah, it basically died because it hurt very bad. And in part because it was all red.
Yeah.
But it's also kind of ugly, to be honest. It's a pretty ugly system.
Yeah.
It's very 1990s. But apparently, Nintendo really didn't intend to release it in that form. I can't remember what media outlet had this, but there was apparently they were working on a color version of it, and basically, Nintendo internal research and development was basically told, no, this is taking too long. Release this. And apparently there was a prototype of that unit, although I can't find the quote.
Maybe they'll dredge that out of the closet and make it like the successor to DS.
Hey, look at this. It takes 10 batteries and costs $300.
Like, I have to say, I mean, I think the technical concept behind Virtual Boy is still fascinating. And if they could do it in color without so much eye strain... I think it is a valid, I think it's a valid path for Nintendo to go down, especially for a handheld.
It was just a big overreach for the time.
Well, yeah. And the reason they had to do it in red for cheapness was that was the only color that LED was available in 95. And in fact, it wasn't until 96 that we got green LED. So now you can make an LED in any color you want.
Yeah. I'm serious. Like, I think it would be really cool with modern technology to kind of redo the Virtual Boy and kind of do it the right way, you know? Because I still think it's a really cool concept that's never been replicated by any other company, including Nintendo. Maybe it can be done. I don't know. But, James, do you have anything else this week?
Besides those three, not really.
All right. That's pretty cool, though. I like that. I want to hear an update on Virtual Boy, especially as you get new games. So, wrapping up new business, I've got a couple things. The main thing I've been playing this week, aside from Secret of Mana, is Prince of Persia, blank of blank for TYP. And this is the high-definition game that came out back in the fall for PS3 and Xbox. And... I'm a pretty big fan of the Prince of Persia series, at least the modern ones. I never really played the 2D games, but I really liked the first one and the third one on GameCube. I didn't really play much of the second one. It's, you know, kind of derided commonly. But I really like the first one and the third one, and I love the art style of the new one. It's all cel-shaded in this sort of unusual way, and it looks kind of like what you would want a high-definition Zelda game to look like, mm-hmm. basically. You know, it's really colorful without being super cartoonish. It's certainly not like Wind Waker level of cel-shading, but it's not ultra-realistic. It's almost Disney-like. It looks kind of like Aladdin, you know, the movie. And it's just gorgeous to look at. The music is fantastic. And I like the story, although it's very mysterious. I mean, the character, your main character kind of jumps in and really out of nowhere with no kind of explanation of who he is or where he's from. And over the course of the game, as you're talking between the two characters, the prince and Elika, who's this princess that he meets in the intro, you learn a lot about her and a lot about her past, but she keeps asking him about his past, and he gives her really trivial details, and even some of those, flippantly. I'm not sure that he's even telling the truth.
He's mostly being really giving her really flippant answers, just basically shut
right.
up. Or make
he's
fun
being
of her.
Coy, so I'm not really sure why, but I think, you know, other than the fact that he's clearly voiced by an American who doesn't really look anything, he doesn't sound like he looks, basically. And his voice is rather out of place considering the setting, which is ostensibly Persia. And
he looks like he's a white guy, really, to be honest.
Kind of. I mean, you don't really get a really good look at his face. And that's part of the cel shading style, is that, you know, these characters aren't super detailed. But he is growing on me as I play through more of the game, in that his attitude, the way that he clearly cares about Elika but kind of doesn't want to let on how much he cares. I like that, and I think it's portrayed in a pretty gradual, natural way. I mean, you can tell as you play more and more of the game that they're sort of bonding, but it's not really abrupt. They don't really like each other much in the beginning, and it's not just they flip a switch and suddenly they're in love or anything, but they're fond of each other. And that's similar to what happened in the first Prince of Persia, Sands of Time, where, you know, the prince and Farah, they kind of hate each other in the beginning, or they at least get on each other's nerves, but by the end, they've really created this bond, and I thought that was handled very well. Mike Sklins, the co-founder of this podcast, thought it made the game pretty much the best thing ever. He just would go on and on about that game's story.
I think the fact that that was lacking from the second game is really, even though the addition of Butt Rock and the absurdist Metal Prince, I think the loss of that personal connection character is really what upset people the most about the game.
And the other part of Warrior Within, the second one that people don't like very much, is that they focused almost entirely on the combat, on improving the combat. Whereas I think the lesson they should have taken from the first game is not that people disliked the combat because it wasn't complex enough. It's that they just thought there was too much of it, and it broke up the main part of the gameplay. It didn't really feel like – it felt like something that was kind of added in to beef it up or something. It didn't really feel like it was part of the game.
Well, so
is the main gameplay.
Part of the reason with that was the combat – there was a lot of counters in it, but it really wasn't all that good. It was basically just counter until you get your hit.
Yeah.
So I think they made the right decision making the combat better. I think that was appropriate, but I think the emphasis they put on it, however, wasn't right. So if they had taken the previous game and made, you know, maybe even if they had focused most of their intention on improving the combat, but kept the previous game stuff around, it'd be fine. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Maybe. But I think it's more I think the issue was not the complexity or the simplicity of the combat. It was just that it broke up the pace too much. And in Warrior Within, because they were so proud of this more complicated combat system they put in, my impression from what very little I played and what I mostly read about it is that they gave it even more combat, which broke up the pace even more.
Yes.
And it felt like it was getting away from being a really unusual 3D platformer, which is really what the series is all about.
See, I feel like this series has not been able, since it made that jump to those 3D games under Ubisoft, because there was a 3D game before that.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically managed to stumble over its own feet sometime every game that's come out so far. Well, like in the third game, that they scaled back the combat, including its complexity, but it was still considerably better than combat in the first game.
Yeah, I thought the third one was a great balance.
Yeah, really, but then they added these like like events that came up there that really weren't that much fun.
The chase things.
The chase things. Yeah.
I thought they were a good idea, but they weren't really executed in a great way. Yeah,
there's always something about this series they just don't get right.
Well, the new one, which I haven't really talked about that much, but I feel like the new one is really hitting a chord with me. Like, I'm really, really enjoying it so far.
Oh, you got to the end yet?
Well, no, I haven't. And I don't think that's going to dramatically change my opinion of it. You know, there are a lot of games with shitty endings. But I'm enjoying playing it.
What's said about it is that it's a sort of non-ending, isn't it? That,
yeah.
That there isn't really a resolution.
I mean, that may piss me off in terms of the story, because, like I said, I am enjoying not so much the story, there's not that much story to it, but I am enjoying the dialogue and the character development. And it could easily piss me off at the end by how it handles those things, but it's not going to take away from the fact that I like playing the game.
No, it does. No, retroactively, it just removes it. You never had that fun, Johnny. Don't lie to yourself.
Although I'm not surprised that it could do that for James.
I'm saying that it had a shitty ending. That's really all it comes down to.
Okay.
It did.
Beyond that, was there something in particular, even my memory is somewhat failing me perhaps, that you didn't like about the game in general?
I seem to recall that the camera drove me nuts sometimes. That's what I said. It was like playing from the Hubble telescope.
What? The camera?
Yeah, sometimes the camera zooms way out to show you the whole stage, and you're this little thing moving across this big stage.
I have not encountered that in about 5 or 6 hours of playing it.
Oh, so you're basically done then. That was my other complaint with the game. I beat it in like 7 hours.
Okay, I may not have played it 5 hours, but I've got 2 of the 4 powers now. So I'm roughly halfway through it, I would assume. Anyway, it is a 3D platformer, and it's very smooth. It is quite easy, but I think having interspersed it a lot with Henry Hatsworth, it's exactly what I needed.
Are they blending together in your mind?
I think it's just a good combination. I'm not going to talk about Henry Hatsworth, but God, it is balls hard the farther you get in. It's fucking ridiculous. So it's a good stress reliever to jump in Prince of Persia and feel awesome. The game is basically designed to make you feel like you're awesome at what you're doing.
Well, you know, it's funny because I actually saw someone buying Henry Hatsworth for their, like, 7-year-old son yesterday. I'm like, oh, that poor child.
I hope he enjoys playing the first world over and over again.
I was better at really hard games when I was 7 years old than I am now.
That's true. That's
a
bad stereotype.
We've talked about this before, you know. I mean, how the bloody hell did the world's children blaze the Milan Secret Castle? You know,
right.
I mean,
because we were
children
better practiced then.
If they get zoned in on something,
they're more patient, I think.
Exactly. They can be. I mean,
we were better practiced
not,
then, too, because all the games were balls hard.
Yeah.
That is true. Yeah, certainly the ones I had.
I mean,
don't think most of the games back then were as hard as Henry Hatsworth. In fact, I have no idea what's going to win the next retroactive poll. Right now, it's still going, but if Super Ghouls and Ghosts wins, I have no fear of it anymore.
Oh, trust me. There really? Are things to fear of Super Ghouls and Ghosts, like the fucking ending.
With the non-ending?
Yeah. No, the good job! Go back to the beginning.
I seriously doubt I'll ever get to that point, even if I'm good at it. But yeah, Henry Hatsworth is like, it's like video game boot camp. It is brutal. Anyway, I didn't want to talk about it. So other than Prince of Persia, which I'm really, really liking so far, I have played a bit of Dragon Quest V this week. I'm really kind of going back to it. I hadn't touched it in a couple weeks because of mainly Henry Hatsworth and Chinatown Wars. But Dragon Quest V, I still think it's pretty much the same as 4. So if you played 4 and got your fill, you don't really need to play 5 for a while. You know, maybe a couple years when it's $20, you can go back and pick it up. But I like Dragon Quest, and so I am enjoying it. And the main thing I wanted to mention this week is that I got far enough in the game that I got to the point where you choose a wife. And unfortunately, the way the game presents it is you literally choose a wife from a lineup.
You, me, go, now.
Yeah.
Yes.
The game presents you with 3 lovely young ladies, 2 of whom you literally do not know. 1 of whom you sort of know because of some past experience. The other 2 are literally strangers. And the game says, Johnny, choose your wife. And the 3
just
women
like real
just
life.
Stand there and wait for you to come up and propose to them. it's kind of unsettling, and I, you know, maybe this maybe this works better in the context of like simple early 90s RPGs, you know, where you don't expect so much from the story.
Maybe it's just the fact that, you know, it's a different culture, yeah, and unfortunately they're not as progressive on gender equality as we are.
Maybe wedding isn't so much, or marriage isn't so much the thing of, you know, relationship as it is in this culture, as is a thing of economic standing.
Yeah,
maybe despite the fact that this is more of a marriage of convenience, this is the best thing that could happen to her. You don't know. Your cultural judgment is just completely based on the lens that you base your life on. You need to expand.
Well, let me put it this way, James. Your main character at this point is essentially a traveling pauper. I think he's like a wanderer. And two of the three girls that you're choosing from are extremely rich. They come from an extremely rich family.
Oh, there you go.
You're marrying up, so your argument fails. Anyway, I'm not trying to kick up a shitstorm about this. It's just noticeable, you know. I thought, wow, this is kind of unintentionally funny the way this is working out.
Yeah, I just think we are talking about a fantasy game here. I mean, you know,
who's fantasy?
Male adolescent fantasy.
You can accept that it's got monsters and all this sort of stuff in
marriage.
It, but when it comes to, they're not as progressive on women's rights in this universe. This is ridiculous. This must be from the mid-90s.
Okay. let me defend my observation just a little bit here, and that if this had happened in, say, Dragon Quest IV, or especially 3, I wouldn't have been fazed, because those games have very little personality. The characters are, you know, they have like random names and shit like that. Mm-hmm. In 5, the game sets out clearly trying to tell more of a story than before. You know, like, things happen to your character that cannot be undone. The characters have names, they have personalities written into them. It's trying more to do a narrative thing. And so then it gets to this point, which is, it's like a branching off point. You make this choice and it affects certain things down the road, which is almost like a very Western style of thing to do in an RPG. But regardless, it's like at this point, the storytelling cred that Dragon Quest V has built up in the previous 10 or 12 hours of gameplay is suddenly boiled down to choose your wife. And it just doesn't mesh very well with the rest of the game.
What if
what
you
saying.
In the game you talk to a character who said, "Yeah, tomorrow I've got my lineup. I have to choose a wife." What if all the characters acknowledged that system existed? Would that save that system?
Yeah, if it was sort of more like, if it were written in that this was the done thing, that this was the culture.
Yeah,
in that
but it's not.
So
that it's
it,
not.
It felt
That's
it felt like so it felt less like obviously artificial.
Well, let me put it this way, okay? As you go to bed the night before, like, they get basically the father of this one of the ladies, you're trying to get a boat and a shield from him or whatever.
So you're going to marry his daughter? Perfect.
Yeah, that's part of it. That's like his dowry to you. So anyway,
that's a shitty
he
dowry.
Basically, he knows that you're trying to choose between these two women which one you're going to take as your wife. And so he says, "Why don't you go sleep on it?" So he pays for you to go to the inn. You wake up in the middle of the night. You go around town. It's like the big talk of the town. It's on everybody's mind. They all have some input. They say, "You should marry this one. You should marry this one." Whatever. Okay, you go back to bed. You wake up in the morning. You go to make your choice. And all of a sudden, one of the girls that you're picking from, her sister runs down from the top floor of the mansion and says, "Okay, I'm going to be in the lineup too." And you don't know anything about her. Like, you could very well have not have even talked to her up to this point. She appears out of nowhere and says, "Okay, I'm your third choice."
She's desperate.
It's fucking ridiculous. I mean, I'm not trying to be a stickler for detail here, but it's totally insane.
Well, maybe it's meant to be a bit of old school comedy farce.
It could be. The game is funny, you know, at times. But it's so crazy.
You know what I mean? I'm just trying to make a point. You could have a culture in a game, in a fantasy world, that was sort of, you know, backward, as we might look
at it, but that's not established.
And that wouldn't be
here
like retrograde. They wouldn't make the game retrograde just by virtue of it having these attitudes.
Do not approve of this cultural judgment calls that we're making on this podcast. This is an inclusive podcast for all listeners of all cultures.
Okay.
I believe this is it 4? One of the games is where they started, where the two franchises, so Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy, started looking at each other more and more. Because in Japan, really, it is these two games.
Right. I would think it's probably around 5. But I don't know the history of the how the two interlace really or compete with each other. I know 5 was, you know, the first one for Super Nintendo. But that point or whatever advancement there was from 4 on the NES to 5 on Super NES is kind of lost now that 4 and 5 are both on DS and they use the same engine. There's not a very stark difference between the two in terms of gameplay or anything like that.
I'm willing to bet there was. Well, that's how I hope there was.
Well, there was a big big difference in graphics and sound.
That's one of the things that I kind of don't like about the fact that they're using the same engine for these games, is that you sort of lose the concept of these games evolving over time.
You know, I think that's a fair point.
So if this is your first exposure to the game, you'd say, well, there wasn't much of a progression here. But in reality, if you knew what the originals were like, you'd say, holy shit, what happened?
Right. You know, in some ways, I do. There are elements of the engine, although it's a very good engine. It is the same as the one they use for 4, and there are aspects of it that I think could have been improved. And it, you know, even they're cranking out 4, 5, and 6 pretty fast, and I kind of wish they had taken a little more time in between, not only to give me more time to rest because I was basically playing 4 up until
they've
5
been,
came
all
out.
All the extra time they've been taking has been allocated to 9, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there was only about 6 months between 4 and 5 in America. So, yeah. And these are long. These are 40-50 hour games easily. So, it's just like, come on, guys, give me a break. And why don't you take a couple extra months to, you know, brush up on the graphics or whatever? Because they're cranking them out.
Take a day off.
Anyway, Dragon Quest V, it's still a good game, but the marriage part I found to be kind of bizarre. And then like an hour of gameplay later, I find out my wife's pregnant. You know,
Woo!
I guess, you know, there's kind of a brief honeymoon scene, except, I mean, it's more like a cinema thing. It's not, you don't even control it. You don't even talk to anybody during that scene, I think. But
does the word, does the line, it's super effective, just come up?
Yeah.
It's just implied.
Yeah, that's new business, and I think we need to take a break now. So we'll be back in a minute to finish up our retroactive discussion of Secret of Mana. Everybody, we are back with your retroactive part 2 for Secret of Mana, and I know James he's not really playing along. I know you've played it many times in the past, but Greg, how much farther did you get since last week?
I got a little further, but I mean, we are recorded somewhat earlier than normal, so the compressed schedule has not sort of helped matters, but so where I'm up to is I got past Spikey that we were talking about last week.
That's good. He is a bastard.
So, yeah, and I'm sort of up to the bit where you sort of come back to the navel. How would you pronounce the what's before it?
Gaia.
Gaia's navel, yeah. So, not too far in the game. I understand you're further than I am, Johnny.
Yeah. So, that's about where I was last week. And this week I've played a fair bit more, and I just got Salamando. So, I'm a couple of elementals past you, basically.
Yeah.
Someone we didn't pull this excerpt from the forums, but someone kind of indicated that there's basically some story in the first hour of the game, and then kind of nothing until the very end. And just having gone through a few more hours, I think that's unfair to the game because it may not be anything dramatic. It's not a massive characterization change like you're about to be at it in Final Fantasy IV, Greg.
No.
you're not going to have any main characters dying. But
messed up, spoiling it there.
It's not just a dungeon crawl, you know. There is much like in a Zelda game, there are things that happen between dungeons that kind of introduce you to different parts of the world. There are kind of enemies that recurring characters who come back in, and you know, a few more shenanigans with the sprite, which are pretty amusing. So I don't think.
And
that's
I mean,
fair.
I don't know that there's that much story at the start. I mean, I don't see that it's that different. I mean, it's pretty much like, you know, you're a normal boy, you're mucking around, you fall, you pick up a sword. Oh yeah, you've got to be banished, and that is pretty much that's it. You know, it's you know, it's, I don't think it's like such a massive like story dump at the start, and then it's I don't know. I just don't see it being as uneven as that makes it sound.
Well, the big difference for me between what I had played last week and this week is not really where I'm at, but it's that today, before we recorded, I got to play for about 2 hours with a friend.
And this is the first
multiplayer I've had in this time through the game. I probably had just a few minutes of it 10 years ago. This was a friend who I found out had played through Secret of Mana on an emulator a few years ago with someone else, and they played through the entire game in one day. I can't imagine what that's like.
He's
familiar with it, but doesn't remember all the details of like where to go in this dungeon or what happens in this town, you know.
Sure, yeah.
Just because he blazed through it so fast. But he knows how to play the game. And so I said, hey, you know, could you help me out? Come over and play the game with me a little bit because I want to try out the multiplayer. So he did. And I think we had a pretty good time. One thing I would note is that I think we progressed through the game faster in multiplayer than I could have doing it all by myself.
Could you sort of pinpoint a reason for that in terms of the logistics?
Well, the combat tends to go a little faster because another player can be more proactive in attacking the enemy than the AI can be.
Do you find there's less management kind of going on because like you don't have to switch to control someone else because the pathfinding's bad and you know all that sort of stuff as well?
I honestly didn't find that to be. I think that it kind of washes out in the mix because when you have another player, sometimes they're trying to go a different direction than you are.
Yeah, so there's still some like coordination.
Yeah, it's just verbal in this case instead of switching over to a different character. The one part where I think the experience falls apart a little bit is like when you go into a town and you want to go buy things, because the other person's just kind of sitting there waiting. And, you know, even if, say, you go into a shop and you buy new armbands for all three of your characters, well, you can equip them on two of them, but then you have to say, hey, why don't you equip it on your character? And then they have to go and fumble around through these menus that they may not use very often. And they do that. I mean, the alternative is they could push start and just give it back over to AI and let you handle that. And then once you're done with the town or whatever, they can push start to jump back in for the combat. But in either case, it ends up being kind of boring for the other person.
Sure, yeah.
I want to bring in I think this is a good time to bring in a comment that Nova Q posted. And Nova Q, we had some of his stuff from last week, but he made an additional comment here that I think is worthwhile. He says, in the last podcast, someone mentioned that it takes a very particular partner to really enjoy playing this game with. I agree, and I'm lucky that the friend I'm playing with is just the right person. We both really enjoy exploring the overworld and dungeons to gain experience and money. If you're the type of person who gets excited watching a progress bar fill, and you can find a friend with a similar affliction, Secret of Mana's basic grinding goodness is for you.
That's just a riveting endorsement of comparing it to a progress bar.
The last time I can remember someone saying that was on the What They Play podcast about a game on Facebook about running a restaurant, which is about as different going a game from Secret of Mana as I can imagine. So that's very weird.
You know, it makes sense to me in that Secret of Mana, the combat itself is not that thrilling to play, but it's very satisfying if you can look at the bigger picture and you see the characters developing, you see weapon levels go up, you see the magic level go up.
Sort of the accumulation element.
And that could be considered an affliction. But it is a part of my personality. It is one thing that I find satisfying in playing games.
Well, and I don't think it's so different from so many other RPGs. You know,
sure,
I mean,
exactly.
It's done in a different way in this, in regards to the
but
combat.
To his point, it can be done with another person, which is different.
Yes, right. That's true. That's what kind of augments it in this case versus other RPGs of the day.
I would say the vast majority played this game by themselves.
Well, that's likely. I mean, we discussed that last week, that, you know, this time in sort of, you know, gaming history, especially in the Western markets, you know, just how likely was it that you was going to have someone that was going to be not only, you know, open to doing this, you know, and all that, but that was going to have that kind of compatibility, you know, to enjoy the specifics of the game. You know, it wasn't
from the
likely.
Bitch sheet, no less.
And I think... it's not so much a matter of finding a partner who's the same skill level as you. I think what Nova Q says is much more important. It needs to be someone who respects the way the game progresses and the way the characters build up and get stronger. Because if you can attach to that, it doesn't take that much skill to play the game. You know, it's
well,
not
and also
particularly
I think someone that perhaps is going to be able to kind of pick it up kind of quickly in the sense that get used to its sort of idiosyncratic qualities, you know, like as we talked about last week, you know, the sort of stat stuff that's going on under the hood, as it were, you know, that you're not really seeing, but you know, because obviously you can explain that to another player, but they've still got to kind of wrap their head around it.
Right. Before we move on with a couple more forum posts, one thing that I've been thinking about, especially today as I was playing the game, and I should have brought this up last week, but you know, last week I talked about how Crystal Chronicles is kind of maybe the spiritual successor to Secret of Mana. If you want to ignore that all the Secret of Mana sequels never happened. but thinking about it, I realized that one of my favorite games ever, the NES game Crystalis, could be considered the spiritual predecessor to Secret of Mana. In that it is a very much a, I mean, at the time, people kind of called it a Zelda clone. But in actuality, right, it was much more RPG-like. And I think the main difference between the way Crystalis works and Secret of Mana, other than the multiplayer, is that if I'm remembering correctly, in Crystalis, you don't see enemies... hit points. You know, like when you attack an enemy, you don't see numbers pop up. It's all just kind of, you just kind of have to get a feel for how many hits it takes to kill something.
Yeah.
Now, your character does have hit points and your character does have magic points. Now, I do think that Crystalis is a little more puzzle-based in general.
Yes.
You have to think, it's a little more cerebral in terms of how you get around the environment and what you do with the magic spells. But it is in many, many, many ways quite similar. So I would say that if you're a big fan of Secret of Mana and you're wishing that, it does seem, you know, it does seem like a unique game, but I think there are other things like it. And Crystalis is a fairly obscure game that, you know, a lot of people probably haven't been able to check out. So unfortunately, it's not on Virtual Console, and we really need that to get fixed one day. It is a wonderful, wonderful game.
There's a Game Boy Color port that's wonked out.
I cannot recommend it in good conscience.
Isn't that like a somewhat similar story to the Bionic Commando one? Like it was done by NST or somebody inside Nintendo.
Yes.
It was really weird, like even though the original game wasn't.
That's right. But Bionic Commando for Game Boy Color is a very, very good remake / sequel to the NES game, whereas Crystalis is a straight-up port. And it's a pretty bad
port. Well, it's a straight up port, and the problem with that is that the dimensions of the screen aren't the same.
Yes.
So there are enemies.
So they had to do some tomfoolery with how the camera moves, and they also changed some of the difficulty balancing. The music sounds like shit because they completely redid the soundtrack. I can't imagine why, because the original has a wonderful NES soundtrack, and they redid all the music. It sounds terrible on the Game Boy Color version. So again, in good conscience, I cannot recommend the GBC version, even though it's probably the easiest version to find.
Oh, easily.
If you have a working NES and you can find the original NES cartridge, I would say go with that. Otherwise, just keep hoping for a Virtual Console release. But if that ever comes out on Virtual Console, you will see me screaming from the rooftops. It is awesome. And it really is very similar to Secret of Mana in a lot of ways, more than it is similar to Zelda, I think.
I would say it's closer to Zelda, but I can see where you're coming from on there.
It's much more RPG-like than Zelda.
Well, yeah, but that goes without saying.
No, it doesn't.
Does it? Not for a lot of people that don't know about this game.
I think you have to
say it. Well, how RPG-like is Zelda, really?
Well, not particularly in terms of the way it handles statistics and things like that. What's what I'm saying? I mean, it is similar to Zelda in many ways, except it's more like... it's kind of like a cross between Zelda 1 and Zelda 2, in that you have magic, you have hit points, you know, all these elements that... Well, not hit point, magic points. You have all these elements that were added to Zelda 2 Adventure of Link, but it's all played from a top-down perspective, and it's more puzzle-based, right?
Yeah.
Exploration-based, like Zelda 1. So it's sort of in between there, and of course the story is different. Anyway, Crystalis, I just wanted to bring it up because I do think... it's an interesting comparison to Secret of Mana, and it's a game that people should go out and find. But maybe we should move on to a final couple of forum posts. And of course, we'll leave the thread open. If you're still playing through it, if you still have thoughts about it, feel free to discuss the game with each other. I'll be checking out that thread as well. We're going to have to move on next week and get away from Secret of Mana in terms of what we do on the show. So this is going to wrap it up. But we did have a couple of posts from previously unheard of members like Cool Bumpty, who posted, quote, "Secret of Mana has been one of my favorite games. I've just completed the game for the third time. I did it with two friends who hadn't played it before and started playing through it with them almost a year ago on the SNES with the multi-tap. Since I didn't want my friends to get bogged down with the grinding while they were over, I ended up spending hours leveling up to the point where sometimes the game was stupidly easy. For me, though, I felt that it was a lot harder to have two partners than to play it on my own, since I know what spells to cast at what point and when it makes sense to just run by the enemies."
So this is quite a different sort of view of the co-op gameplay in terms of one person doing a lot of the heavy lifting so the others can enjoy it.
Well, because this game sort of lends itself to just one person doing all the heavy lifting because, you know, it was originally designed as a one-player game anyway. So I think you can get away with that pretty easily. So, you know, if you're playing with people who don't really know the game that well, I would say you probably are at an advantage to just play it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it is, there do come points where, even today I was playing with my friend, and he's played the game before, you know, he's not an expert at it, perhaps, but he beat the game a couple years ago, and, you know, there were points where I said, hey, you know, maybe you should use a different spell on this boss, because it's not really hurting him, or, you know, why don't you tell the girl, who is the AI character that neither of us was controlling, I said, why don't you tell the girl to cure you, because you're getting low on hit points and we're out of items. It was like, you know, I kind of had to suggest things to him because he didn't know offhand. You know, he hasn't been playing it for the past 2 weeks like I have been. So, you know, in those cases, there were times when I thought this would be easier if I was just doing it myself. Definitely. But I think the other really interesting point in Cool Bumpty's post is the idea of him doing all the grinding for his friends. And so, like, what did they do when they came over? Did you just save right before a boss and they come over and they just beat the boss's ass and then move on and they leave and then you spend another day grinding?
You can play the stages. I mean, I bet he was out in the field just grinding.
Like in the caves?
Yeah.
I mean, for me, the way to play the game is to grind a little bit as you go. You know, not to spend 3 hours leveling up in some random field.
He only had limited time that his friends could play with him, though, so he wanted to make sure that they could breeze right on through the story bits.
Yeah, I guess that was kind of the main point, is that they could sort of experience sort of seeing the different places and things as quickly as possible.
Well, I'd be interested to hear what his friends thought of the game as presented to them in that fashion, because I feel like they're probably missing the point if he's playing so much of the game for them. I mean, to me, the experience of going through that process and building up the characters is a very large part of the game's charm and what makes the game what it is. So,
I mean, I'm speaking as someone who's never played it in multiplayer, but you know, some of the conceptual sort of appeal of multiplayer for this is that it would make the grinding more palatable to me personally.
Yeah.
Whereas,
yeah,
of course,
exactly,
in this case, he's actually taking it all on himself. But he's kind of doing it. He's not so much he's making it more palatable. He's actually doing more of it because he's going to play it in multiplayer. So it's the complete opposite of how I would look at it. So it's quite interesting.
To me, this would almost be analogous of like kind of having a group session through Super Mario Brothers, but you only bring your friends into the room when you get to the water levels. It's like, really? That's the part that you want to show them?
Yes.
I mean, that's not really the bulk of the game. That's not really the meat. you know, that's not the memorable part necessarily. And it's, and I just feel like I'd be interested to hear what his friends think, because I think if I was invited over to play a game that had been sort of pre-played for me in that fashion, I'd probably think this is a really slight kind of experience. It's not really that memorable or interesting. You know, it is stupidly easy, but at the same time, there's not that much for me to do. You know, I just run in and cast the Thunderbolt spell on the snake boss 4 or 5 times, and then he dies. Like, what is this game about? You know?
Yeah.
That's a strange story to me, but, you know, thanks for sharing the experience for sure. So, the last post is again about multiplayer. Ski Dragon posted, "The main reason I sometimes consider this to be my favorite game is because of the multiplayer. I can think of no other game that really shares this formula. Of course, nowadays nobody would have both the time and will to play through any significant chunk of the game with me. Since I know the game is not nearly as good as a single-player experience, I am not dedicating any time to it at the moment." I guess, personally, I would just argue that, you know, I don't think an hour is a huge kind of dedication to make to the game, and the way the multiplayer works is that it's very easy for a friend to drop in and play for a little while and then drop back out, and then they're not responsible for what happens after that. So just like I did today, it was pretty easy to invite a friend over. We enjoyed a couple hours of Secret of Mana together, and if he never plays it again with me, that's okay. You know, I mean, we had a good time, but it's not like he screwed me over by not committing to playing through the entire adventure together. And again, the story is not that spectacular, so I don't really feel bad getting him to play this sort of out-of-context portion in the middle, because as long as I can explain the mechanics, you know, and he can have a good time, then it was time well spent. That's what I feel personally. I think some people are making this more daunting a prospect than it needs to be. It's not like you have to have somebody sit down and play through 20 hours of this with you in order to have a good time with it.
And I mean, I think it does still, as Scotty James has said, it does function as a single player experience, certainly. I mean,
I agree. I've had a really good time with it.
I've been getting on better with it this time rather than in the 90s, because, you know, I've just more, like, I can understand more what's going on with the sort of the RPG style stuff, and I'm just more accepting of it. And yeah, it's going quite well. I mean, I'm not sure how much I'm going to manage to push on with it in the future, because, you know, there's lots of stuff coming up. But
you're playing two RPGs at once. That's always
exactly. That is. Although they are so different, though. They are very, very different. That's quite true. Comfortable with that.
That's true.
Well, I wanted to mention something. This is something that happens later in the game to a point that I've never got to either back then or now. That, you know, kind of always made my eyes light up when I was the only marginally less cynical and bitter person I was back in the mid-90s, which is the Flammy, the dragon thing that you fly around on, you can traverse the map.
He's cute as hell, isn't he?
Yeah, he's always adorable little characters. I remember seeing the screenshots and stuff. You know, you look like the old classic kind of Super NES Mode 7 navigating around, and I never actually got to do that, because I think it's about 2/3 of the way through the game, isn't it?
Maybe half. I'm pretty close to it myself, where I am. Yeah, so I think it's maybe about half. But it's pretty exciting when you get it. I mean, and the music is a big part of that. The Flammy song when you're flying around is pretty
awesome.
Yeah,
I've heard that. Yeah.
And it's very nice. I think your goal should be to play through that part, Greg, because I think that's a good experience to have. And I think once you've gotten to Flammy, you can safely say, well, I experienced Secret of Mana. You know, like, I know what it's about. I've been through that, even if you don't complete it.
So I assume it is the way that, you know, obviously in Zelda games, like, you know, as it goes on, for a certain length of time, you're stuck on foot and there's nothing really you can do. And then after a while, you can basically warp to places. So this is like that, but it's more interactive.
Yeah, I guess.
You know, you can just sort of skip, to somewhere by flying around on Flammy through this sort of 3D thing, and then
are you comparing it to, for instance, the horse in Ocarina of Time?
Yeah, sort of like a cross between the horse and the bird in Link to the Past.
I would say it's more like the airships in Final Fantasy, which I know is a reference that doesn't mean much to you yet, but it's more that it now, you know, it opens up a lot of area for you to explore that you couldn't before.
So that's the key difference between some of these things in Zelda, is that you are actually, I don't think there's anywhere like you could only go with the horse, or you know.
No.
It's usually just a matter of convenience, whereas with this you are literally expanding your horizons.
The horse is you but faster, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And it's more than just making you faster, it's letting you go to places. Anyway, so that's going to wrap up Secret of Mana. I hope you all enjoyed playing through it as we did. And remember that the poll for the next retroactive game is ongoing. It will be ongoing for a couple of days after this episode gets put out. So if you haven't voted yet, make sure you go in there and do that. This poll is made up entirely of games that have been in previous polls and lost. So one of these games is going to get played. And I think we're going to try to do that every fifth poll from here on. So basically, this is poll number 5, or the poll for retroactive number 5. And then we'll do it again for number 10, maybe. I think that's probably about the right pace to do this kind of remix poll. So I'm hoping this will settle some of the angst over people who nominated games and it didn't win the poll. So... And it'll force us to play something that is maybe not so insanely popular. These are all games that I don't think there's a very obvious or clear winner in here. Some people thought there has been in the past. So I think it's going to be really interesting. And I think no matter what wins, we're going to have a pretty interesting game to choose to go through and play. So anyway, I hope you'll go vote in this and all future retroactive polls. So now we're going to jump into listener mail. We've got 3 questions here that we're going to blaze through.
Yep, so I'll have the first one. This is Matt from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and he says, "Hey guys, love the show. It's the highlight of my week. But to the matter at hand, high-speed SD cards. In episode 139, you mentioned that the SD channel takes 45 or so seconds to put the card and load games. I have a SanDisk Extreme 3 and the SD channel seems to load 2.5 pages of games in around 15 seconds and launches large games in 10 seconds or less." This was you, Johnny, that had this experience with the 45 seconds. And now, when you said 45 seconds, just to put it into terms that Matt's talking about, how many pages of games was that?
Well, okay, so here's the thing. The way the SD card channel works is that it's supposed to, you see this message that it's loading, and then once that goes away, the games kind of fall in like dominoes one by one, right? They fill in. For me, they didn't even start filling in until 45 seconds.
Oh,
so
well,
it took over a minute to have all of them loaded up and ready to go.
Yeah, I didn't really appreciate that at the time because
it was obnoxious.
It's quite radically different from my. Although, I mean, I've tested with 2 different SD cards. There's definitely quite a significant difference between the two, but they were probably both not nearly as long as that. If it's even before the process begins, from what I would think of it.
I had probably 30 games on the card, which is a lot. But it's not unreasonable, certainly. I mean, it holds like 240 or something.
That's 2.5 pages, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, basically 2.5 to 3 pages. And the funny thing is that it didn't actually take very long to load up a game. Once I got the menu and I could look at my games, I could choose even a really large one, and it loaded up in 10 or 15 seconds, which is the pretty standard. So it was an issue of indexing. So that was one factor that led me to replace my SD card. The other is that I'm pretty sure there were some corrupted sectors on it. I'm not even sure if SD cards use sectors in the hard drive sense. But there were portions of the memory, the file table, that were corrupted. So I figured, okay, I'm going to buy a new SD card. So I looked online. I went to Newegg. I found an 8-gig card for about $15. This is a ridiculous deal. And I checked the speed rating on it, and it's significantly faster than the one that I had. So it moves a lot more megabytes at a lot faster speed. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go ahead and order this. It's super cheap. So I went ahead and placed that order, and then I thought, well, I'll save myself a lot of time if I can back up my old SD card to my computer, and that way when my new one comes in, I can just move all my channels over to the new one, and I don't have to re-download them all from the shop channel. So I tried to do that, and this old SD card I had was so fucked up that I couldn't even copy anything from it over to my computer's hard drive. So I pretty much threw it away. I mean, I just...
So what are you having to do now? Like, just re-download from the shop channel to your new SD card?
That's right. So about a week ago, I got my new SD card, and it's awesome. I mean, for $15, it's incredible. It's huge. It has like 61,000 blocks on it or something, according to the shop channel. And it's really fast. So even with about the same number of channels on it that I had with the old one, it loads up in about 10 or 12 seconds now. Indexing. Nice, so it's much, much easier to use. And because I couldn't back up to my PC, I had to re-download all of these. So basically, I put on my iPod and sat down and downloaded I spent over an hour downloading games. And I think I've bought about 50 games on Virtual Console, which is kind of frightening. I mean, I haven't calculated how much money that was. Some of it was basically paid for by Nintendo or other publishers when we were doing reviews, but most of it I bought with my own money, and it's hundreds of dollars for sure. Kind of terrifying. Yeah, anyway, all is good. All is well with the world now.
Yeah, it just goes to show. I mean, you know, you might want to kind of look at your, you know, performance with your SD card, and, you know, like you said, there's probably some pretty good deals out there with something that's more high performance. Just because the SD card slot was so useless before, it wasn't really much of a sort of stress test to see how your SD card was, you know.
Exactly.
Whereas now, you know, it will be exposed whether it's any good or not.
Anyway, James has the next question.
Master Ryu writes, "Hello, new listener to your show. Now a big fan because of the lovely British voice of one of your podcasters. You know, I don't think I've ever gotten fan mail. I'm hurt. John got fan mail, but that was of my own device.
That was from you. Yeah,
that was good.
Greg gets about 10 times more than any of the rest of us. That's for sure. So there is more to this letter from Master Ryu.
Yeah. Anyhow, since there's a curious lack of British main characters in Wii games, Lara Croft notwithstanding, can you be kind enough as to pitch an idea to Nintendo or a third party?
Henry Hatsworth for Wii.
I was going to say...
Henry Hatsworth is clearly the most representative British character ever.
Indeed.
We were all thinking it. Just want to be the first one to say
it. It is glorious. Hatsworth came in this week. I've only played it very briefly, but you know, all the good show sort of thing and all that. the tea time and the
I can't even believe.
Do you like the nod to Professor Layton and Luke?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty overt.
It is pretty much, isn't it, with his little banjo kazooie speak, like, as well.
There's
like hidden in there. There's like just little bits that are like pure gob. Like, you know, will actually sort of say like right, or you know, there's like little token Briticisms in there somewhere. But yeah, though, I mean, do we need more British characters after Hatsworth? I don't know whether we do.
You know, there's the Harry Potter games, and there's a new one coming out in May, I think, with the new one. So there's that. And of course, you know, there's some amazing British actors in those films. I'm not sure if they have the same voice actors for the games. I think the kids or the teenagers, you know, the main characters do the voice. I think those are the same actors. But for instance, Alan Rickman as Professor Snape, I'm not sure that he is in the game.
I think they reuse a lot of audio from the movies whenever they can, and then otherwise they just bring in someone who sounds like the main character.
Well, as I was talking about with Spyro, they got like people like Gary Oldman and stuff in.
But those aren't really British voice, characters. Those are...
No, they're not. Because it's a fantasy setting.
Because they're fucking dragons.
Exactly, but they sort of like with Lord of the Rings, you know, you've got a lot of British actors, but no one's British in Lord of the Rings because Britain doesn't exist.
Yes.
Whereas with Harry Potter, it does, but it's still a fantasy setting. It's kind of abstract, like, you know, it's a bit...
Yeah.
It's not sort of our one... it's not a main character by any means, but I want to give a shout out to one of the better, and by which I mean worse, British characters ever in video game, which is Carrington from Perfect Dark.
Oh, yes.
Who apparently was meant to be Scottish, but really sounded like a sort of very, very bad Sean Connery impression crossed with Sir Richard Attenborough's accent in Jurassic Park. That was awesome. It was
in Perfect Dark have British accents because, you know, it is set in England and it's made by an English company, Rare.
I thought it was set in Chicago.
It is set in Chicago.
Isn't Joanna's British, though?
Yes, but I never understood that. With Carrington and some of the other things, it was always a kick to remind me Rare is British.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and like, this is the best.
It's
they
hard
can
to
do.
Believe sometimes, but
yeah, I know. I just thought it was so funny that they managed to come up with a character that I would have sort of accredited as being the product of somebody that knew nothing about the British Isles.
Right, it came who lived there.
Yeah.
So for a little more serious answer to Master Ryu's question, I would say Dragon Quest Swords is a good place to start.
What?
Pretty good. What? What do you mean?
He's not looking for accents. He's looking for characters.
Well, they're not. I mean, obviously, Dragon Quest isn't set in England.
Yeah, sort of back to the Lord of the Rings thing again. You know,
sure. I mean, if that bothers you, you know, I was just going to say Dragon Quest Swords and the upcoming Dragon Quest IX for Wii, which we'll see in 2018, they will have a lot of authentic British voice acting and, you know, British acted characters. And so.
Angus, Dragon Quest VIII.
Yeah.
It truly, truly terrible voice acting.
Well, yeah,
or rather accent.
It's rather intentional, I have to say. I mean, you know, Yangus is a completely over the top and ridiculous character to begin with. So I don't think they were looking for, you know, sublime acting from that guy.
All of
the characters in the Dragon Quest series are British, except for the occasional French girl. With almost nothing on. So, look forward to that. I guess Lara Croft is actually from England.
Yeah, she's nobility.
I'm not sure how many other games you could... I mean, technically, Henry Hatsworth isn't English. He's from T-Land.
Yes, which is in no way connected to England.
We're going to split hairs here.
Yes.
Well, wouldn't that technically make him Indian?
Of course, you could go with the James Bond games, you know. Quantum of Solace. I'm not sure why you'd want to play the Wii version, but it's there.
Because it's terrible, and you enjoy terrible games because you're a terrible person. That's the only reason you would want to buy that game.
Well, I know Modern Warfare, which of course was not released on Wii.
No.
That one does have a British campaign.
But they are kind of your standard stereotypes, though.
Well, you know, that caveat was not put into the question. So.
No, it was not. No.
If Modern Warfare 2 is released on Wii in addition to the other platforms, which I think would be a wise decision.
I guess this is kind of the point, though, isn't it? You know, if you've got Rare and they're delivering bloody Carrington, you know, what hope is there for anyone else to deliver a sort of nuanced, grounded portrait of someone that's representative of Britain? It's not going to happen.
Actually, my favorite part of Call of Duty 4 was your commander's very, quote, British mustache that wrapped, like, in a curve all the way around his cheeks.
No, not the kitchen mustache. Yes. No.
It's horrible.
You know what says British? You know what says Britain in Modern Warfare? So, a poster from World War I.
Your king needs you.
What the hell?
God. Oh, well. All right, so the final question is from Brandon, and he writes, the last few weeks you've fielded questions about demos and rentals of Virtual Console games, and you've given pretty good reasons why neither will ever happen. I agree with those points entirely, but what about just a 50% discount for certain titles every now and then? There's lots of games that I'd buy if they didn't cost quite so much. Xbox Marketplace has taken to running sales with some regularity, so it's obviously working for them.
Because Microsoft is proactive in this online world.
Well, again, we, you know, it's not necessarily all the same, but, you know, as we've seen, we've discussed in these sort of aforementioned occasions, you know, Microsoft does have a very different attitude. I mean, they'll do stuff like take stuff off.
They'll let you have online friends, not friend codes. I mean, it's a whole different world.
I think it is within the realm of possibility. Just because we haven't seen them do it yet doesn't mean they have a policy against it.
No, I'd agree with that. I still think it's fairly unlikely. But yeah, because as we've said, like, Microsoft has this sort of attitude of, you know, like, if stuff isn't performing very well, they'll take it down and all that, you know. Mm-hmm. Nintendo certainly hasn't sort of demonstrated anything like that, like they'd, you know, they'd like reduce the price first or then take it down or any, pretty much just put it up there, see what sticks kind of attitude, really.
Okay, you know, so the reason that they haven't done this yet is because Wiis are still selling like crazy. So every month, there are hundreds of thousands of new people who own a Wii who may go check out the Wii Shop channel and who didn't even realize that Super Mario Brothers was available. So for from Nintendo's perspective, it doesn't make any sense to drop prices because they can still sell at full price to so many new customers. So I think the possibility exists once Wii system sales slow down. Because now they're like, how can we sell more games to the people who already bought the system?
Once you reach that kind of saturation point, perhaps they may do something different. Because as you said, at the moment, you've got this stream of new people. And it certainly that those people are a very significant percentage of the revenue that's coming in is backed up by how frequently, you know, Super Mario Bros. 3 and all that is on that top most downloaded on the shop channel itself. You know,
when you see, you know, when you see Player's Choice exist for retail Wii games, you'll probably see something similar happen for the digital distribution Wii games as well.
Yeah.
But that's not going to happen while the hardware is still selling out.
But of course, I mean, there's been evidence of it slowing down in Japan.
Yes,
recently.
I'm not saying it's not ever going to happen.
When you look at the DS and you look at, I mean, it might take a long time, or it may never cross that threshold wherever it would be for Nintendo to so. I mean, I'm not sure, but you're absolutely right. It is an important point that even though you might say your digital downloads and or your old games and all this, it's so kind of core gamery, traditional gamery, whatever you want to say. It looks like, you know, it's not like people buying all like the newest stuff that's always like the most popular. It is, you know, the Super Mario 3s, the Punch Outs. DKC, you know, like this kind of stuff that's so frequently up there. WiiWare's a little different, but even that has its, you know, has its sort of old favourites, like all the time, like Dr. Mario, and World of Goo has become quite a perennial sort of hit as well.
I'll tell you, the last time I was home and I got to play around on my my sister and her husband's Wii, I saw that they had. They don't regularly have their Wii connected to the internet because they have one of these like mobile phone cards that goes in. It's like a cell phone, like a cellular data plan card that goes into their laptop. So they can't get the Wii online through that. But every now and then they take it to a friend's house who has a Wi-Fi hotspot or something, and they set it up there. And they will actually go to the trouble of going to the shop channel. So the last time I went, we were on a family vacation. We're up at this condo in the mountains, and we had internet there. So they brought their Wii, and they decided to take it online and see what's on the shop channel. And I see that they've got $50 worth of Wii points on their system that they had not used yet. And they've already downloaded 7 or 8 games. They've got Bomberman and Mario and Punch-Out and Donkey Kong Country 2 and all kinds of crazy shit. They're the most casual users you can imagine. So I don't think it's just the hardcore who are interested in virtual console.
Exactly.
I think it's more casual than we think it is. Really,
yeah, no, well, you know. Well, you might think it is. You know, some people might think it is, and I suppose in that sense, like you said, you know, they're quite happy to have those people come in, pay full price, you know, for the time being, and I suppose if they feel that the only way you'd kind of envision them doing a lot of sales or promotions is just at such a time where the revenue tails off. And they want to give it a shot in the arm, you know, get people going to the shop channel again or something. But again, it's debatable whether that will ever happen. I don't know. I mean, do you think with the Microsoft example that, you know, they do need to do that? That, you know, they don't have the same kind of robust selection of retro games, so they need to give people reasons to keep going?
I think in the case of Microsoft stuff, you know, most of it is newly developed software. And so if it's not selling the way you'd like it to, well, you need to try to do whatever you can to get some sales up to make money, you know?
Exactly. Because you're not going to have brand new Xbox customers take the system home and go through Xbox Live Arcade and start buying a bunch of esoteric stuff that they've never heard of before. I mean, that's the difference with Virtual Console, is that this stuff has name recognition.
Exactly.
People know what Mario 3 is, you know?
Yes.
So they will gravitate towards that, whereas with Xbox, you kind of have to have a, you know, you have to be pretty tuned in to be aware that You know, there are new arcade games every week. There's always a demo. You know, what's coming out this week? Go to Major Nelson's blog. So I think that in that case with the arcade titles, they are targeting more new customers, people who are more interested in getting a good deal. They're not going off nostalgia.
So, yeah, you know? So the sort of savvy consumers and all that. And so, you know, they can reasonably expect that when they do one of these promotions that people will actually know about it, the people they're trying to get to, and then take advantage of it, you know. So, I think the point is that the Xbox marketplace, your market is more akin to what you might think the Wii Shop Channel audience is, but in fact it isn't. You know what I mean?
It's much closer to regular retail, I think, is a better way of putting it. I think 360 follows a very brick and mortar style of business model. So there's stuff there at a price, and that price is much more fluid based on how old it is and trying to spurt to get some more sales.
Yeah, and because they are new games for the most part, yeah. Or, you know, I mean, there'll be new versions of games, at least, you know, like something like there's a new version of Space Invaders Extreme, or, you know, there's a new version of Meteos, or the R-Type Dimensions, or, you know, even if they are things that are kind of have existed before, they have some level of sort of newness, and
right.
And so that's kind of what it is a different environment to stuff that is just so purely retro, and like Johnny said, it has that kind of mainstream recognition in a lot of cases that, you know, it's just totally unique.
So that's kind of in the show. Thanks everybody for listening, and we should have John back for you next week for the full complement. We will be talking about Super Metroid next week, and we will probably try to touch on the Game Boy 20th anniversary as well. Although we're not going to have time to do both in full force.
Certainly not.
Yeah, but we will touch on it. I'm sure there is the Gunpei Yokoi connection there, and please keep sending the great emails. We've had some really good ones, and we will get to them. The address for that is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please do remember to vote and participate in Retroactive, and we'll see you next week. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye bye.
I was waiting for that third goodbye, but there isn't going to be one.
That's right. Aw, tear.